On Talk Radio 98.5 and 1240 WRTA is WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen with us. Tom Butzler from Penn State Cooperative Extension, horticulture educator. Tom, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me on today, Doug.
And the joke line we could probably start with, although it's something that's serious we wanted to talk about. Hot enough for you? Because this week it certainly was.
Yeah. You know, we've been put in kind of a lull, Doug, in that, you know, the past several weeks have not been bad. Yeah, we had some hot weather here and there, but it was only for a couple days. And then the nights were cool. The days were kind of pleasant. We got a couple periodic rain. So, you know, really nice weather. But, yeah, I think true summer is coming, or it's here, I guess.
Yeah, well, we were whining about how cold it was. Now we can whine about how hot it is. And it's always going to be one or the other. I think that I'd rather take it be a bit warm than freezing cold. So what are we going to have to do as far as watering? You tend not to water things the way, you know, like I think we talked about where I grew up on Long Island. Everybody had the lawn sprinklers out. Nobody has that around here.
Right, right. Well, we've talked about this before. I don't think it's as much keeping up with the Joneses here in central Pennsylvania than some more of those urban areas that have money where, you know, things got to look really sharp, I guess. But, yeah, you know, it's going to get hot. And, you know, depending on what you've got in your garden or your landscape, you may need to do some supplemental watering. So, for example, Doug, most people that have vegetable gardens, they have tomatoes, right? And so tomatoes really need a lot of water. There's a lot of foliage on there. And once you start getting tomatoes on there, those tomatoes are 98% water. So that's a big sink. And if we don't get water, or if those fruit don't get water, we get what is commonly referred to as blossom end rot. The bottom end of the tomato, the part that's away from the stem, it's the other end, starts to rot. And it's a calcium deficiency that's causing the tissue to break down, but calcium moves in water very readily. And if there's not water moving throughout the vascular system of that plant a good deal, then calcium can't move, and then we get this rot on the bottom end of the tomatoes. So that is a common problem during hot, dry summers. So really what you need to do is water, and not every day, but, you know, you might want to water two or three times a week. Kind of the general rule of thumb, Doug, is you probably want about 1 inch of water, 1.5 inches of water on your garden a week. You know, just imagine your garden like a big pan, and then you'd have an inch of water, you know, up the side of that pan. That's how much water you would need on a weekly basis, give or take a little bit. You know, if we get some rain, not as much, and if it gets really hot and dry, maybe a little more. But to keep those plants kind of thriving.
Now, would it help more to water them more often, or to water them and add some calcium supplements or some such?
Yeah, that's a good question, and really the idea is that you don't water them frequently, because if you water them frequently, and you're training those roots to stay near the surface, you want those roots to go deep down into the soil profile so they can mine not only the water but the nutrients that are there. So the idea of watering on a daily basis, that's just not recommended. But you know, once or twice a week would be enough. And Doug, is making sure that those tomatoes are mulched. You don't want bare soil in your garden, because you spend that time and effort watering, and then you get a hot day and that soil is just exposed. It evaporates fast. So hopefully most folks have got leaf mulch around their tomato plants or whatever plants they have in their garden. Or, I use some. Depending on what I have, I use leaf mulch early on, and then I get some a roll of brown paper, you know, that people paint on, and I use that as kind of a mulch layer. I mean, anything you can find to create a barrier between this hot atmosphere and the soil surface to slow down that water loss.
You know, it's funny. I've not seen most people use mulch in a vegetable garden. Flower gardens sometimes, shrubbery, yeah, often trees, sure. But I remember my dad never did that. But then again, that was, you know, decades ago when he was doing hit or miss. And he also was watering all the time. And he had me weeding a couple of days a week during the summer. So that kept that stuff down. But the evaporation, yeah, would have been a problem there.
Well, you just said two things there. Watering all the time and weeding. And so that's what mulching in the vegetable garden will reduce, not eliminate, but reduce. So, you know, if you just have bare soil to that in your garden, you're going to be out there watering every other day. I mean, you're going to be losing so much water. And that's just a huge time suck. And then maybe the other thing, 95 degrees, do you really want to be out there, you know, standing there and watering and going filling up the can or however you water? So that mulch reduces the amount of watering and the time spent. But the other thing, and we've talked about this before too, is that mulch acts as a barrier to light. And a lot of our weeds need sunlight to germinate. So if you can block that sunlight, you're going to reduce your weed problem. I'm not saying eliminate it, but the amount of time you're out there weeding, and what an awful task, Doug, when it's 90 degrees out. You just don't want to do it.
No. So this is the voice of experience on both ends. I get the feeling we don't want to do that, but sometimes you have to.
Yeah. Well, I get that, but. I mean, there are multiple benefits of mulching. Hey, the other thing I got to tell you, I was talking to someone the other day, and they were talking about their tomatoes and some of the problems they had with their tomatoes, and he talked about how he managed them during the summer. And he talked about the blossom end rot, and I said, well, that's a water issue. And he says, yeah, but I stand over my tomato plant with my hose and set up the sprinkler. They set up a sprinkler and have the sprinkler going for hours. And I said, well, you know, that is a really incorrect way to water, because now you're getting water all over those leaves. And something we've talked about, a lot of our spores need a water droplet on the leaf surface to start the infection process. So yeah, you might be getting water to the roots. I mean, you will be getting water to the roots, but now you're encouraging disease issues on those leaves. So if you're going to water, make sure you do it properly. And that is getting the water to the base of the plant, not to the leaves or the foliage.
Well, if you, it would be more ideal if you did have it on the ground in some way, shape, or form as opposed to spraying it. But if you do it, say, at high noon when you're going to have sun for multiple hours as opposed to 7 p.m. when you're not going to have sun that much, and it is going to probably give you more rise to mold or something like that, are you okay then, or should you still try to keep it off the leaves when you're doing that?
So that's a good comment, Doug. And I would say if you set up a sprinkler and it's going to be sunny all day, you probably would be okay to do that. The overhead watering, the leaves get wet, and they'll dry pretty rapidly. Because a lot of these spores, they need a certain time frame to start the infection process, several hours. So if you apply water on the leaves and it dries within a half an hour, then you're probably going to be fine. But if the water stays on the leaves, it's overcast day and it's just kind of hanging out there, those leaves stay wet for several hours, then you got a problem. So if it's a sunny day, yeah, that would be fine. But if it's getting around 6:30 at night, 7 o'clock at night, you got home from work and you see the garden's kind of dry, you wouldn't want to do overhead watering at that point, because there's the possibility that those leaves will stay wet almost all night into the morning. And then we got to dew, and so they'll stay wet even longer, and that's when you'll run into problems.
Something along these lines, just taking a slight detour here, when you water something, I remember that I got my folks a coosa dogwood as a gift one year, and because they had always wanted one. And when it was much younger, I would take the hose out there when I'd be visiting and let the hose run, because somebody who we had it professionally planted said, oh, you should probably do that. My dad was like, yeah, but you're putting it to the surface so the roots won't get as deep, something that you just said. Would that work as well for if you plant a seedling or a tree, you don't want to be sitting there running water to it at the surface all day?
Well, it depends. You know, so if you put a hose there and it's running all day, that's just bad.
Well, or maybe an hour or something.
Yeah. You know, as long as it's not full blast, that would be okay, because that's one of those long, deep watering events. As long as it's not just running off. Like if you're on a hillside and it's just running down the hillside and not going into the soil itself, then that's a problem. But no, that would be okay. But, you know, and you do need to think about what kind of soils you have too. If they are soils that do not drain very well, for example, very high in clay content, putting all that water, like running it something for an hour, that soil becomes super saturated. And, you know, if that water doesn't drain off, and I'm talking about in a day or two, those roots could drown. And that, you know, I think people kind of forget that roots breathe. They cannot be submerged 100% in water. There's an exchange of gases that occurs underneath the soil in those roots. And so they need airspace. And if you do that watering for long periods of time and all the time, you're pushing the air out of those microscopic air pockets, and you're filling it up all with water, and those roots will drown. So there is a line there that you have to be aware of. You know, you do want to put water there, and especially you mentioned kind of a new like coosa dogwood or seedlings.
Yeah.
For anyone that has planted this spring, you're going to need to water those trees. Now, you know, I've got oaks that have been in the landscape for 15 years. I'm not going to water those. Those are so well established. I'm not concerned about that. But, you know, I planted some pawpaw seedlings or young trees early this spring, and I'm going to have to water those probably if this heat continues for a couple weeks, because they're just not established.
So the seedling that I have, this tree I've been trying to grow, this redbud, which, by the way, yeah. You know, the thing that bugged me was you would go to certain big box stores and say, I'd like to buy a certain amount of chicken wire to put around it. Oh, you have to buy this whole roll.
Yeah.
Might want to go to your friendly neighborhood, Mallows. I'm not getting anything for it. I paid for the chicken wire. You might want to go to your friendly neighborhood store as opposed to the big box store, and they'll cut it to size. But as far as that, I mean, it's growing faster than a weed now that we've had some rain, we've had some heat,
yep.
And it's getting a little taller, a lot taller than it was last year when some rabbit got to it or deer or something. But something like that I'm going to have to water if we get to the 100-degree temperatures, but not as a regular basis. Because so far I haven't done any watering to it.
I would just keep an eye on it. You know, stick your finger in the ground. It's, you know, it's just, like I said, I've got some oaks that have been in for a decade and a half, and that's such an established tree, I'm not really going to worry about it. But, yeah, for something that's relatively new in the ground, that could be a concern. And, you know, just like you were talking about mulch in the vegetable garden, you're on that redbud seedling, you would want that mulch too.
Okay. Would this be a good indicator? If the grass around it or in your yard is turning brown as opposed to the healthy green which we have right now, or at least for most of its healthy green, you don't have to water. But if the grass is starting to get brown, maybe you better be watering the seedlings, et cetera.
Yeah. You start seeing grass go brown. It's under drought stress, and not that the grass is dying. It just goes into a somewhat of a semi-dormant state because, one, it's hot, and it just doesn't have access to water. So, yeah, and grass can withstand several weeks of hot, dry temperature. But if we would go all summer, 3 months of hot, dry weather, that would eventually kill the grass. But our grasses will be able to withstand this weather we have coming up. Not a problem.
I'm surprised how well it comes back over the course, because last year there was a couple of weeks that it was really stinking hot. I didn't mow the lawn for like 3 weeks because it just wasn't growing and it wasn't green. And we finally got some decent rain. It was like, okay, now I feel I can safely do this. And, I mean, it's just incredibly resilient, which surprised me.
Yeah. Nah, grass is pretty tough. And so I wouldn't worry about that. And I never irrigate my grass. I'm not too worried about it. It goes dormant. That's fine. Semi-dormant. And that's fine. Once we get into some cooler weather and get some rain, it kind of perks back up. I guess, you know, the thing you have to worry about lawns when it's in that semi-dormant state is that a little more fragile. So if you were going to play a softball game on it, or you know, you're going to recreate a FIFA soccer game or whatever, you could do some damage to that grass then, because it's a little more brittle. It doesn't have that ability to recuperate from some wear and tear.
Or if you're going to have a backyard cookout and everything is dry, You're going to have a lot of guests wandering over the grass. Maybe it's you're going to have to do a little more lawn care with that.
Yeah, in the fall, you might have to pay attention to some reseeding issues, yeah.
It's WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen from Penn State Cooperative Extension. Horticulture educator Tom Butchler is with us. We were talking about lawn care, and you wanted to make a couple points before we move on from that about when you're mowing it and how else you're going to have to take care of it this summer.
Yeah, you know, right before the break, we were talking about lawns and the summer heat and so forth. And, you know, they go somewhat dormant. They're still alive. But when there's some wear and tear on them, they don't recover as well. And so knowing that, one thing you want to do is if you go out there and mow the lawn or, you know, try to get rid of some of the weed seed heads, you need to raise the mower deck. Do not mow low. So this is the time of year where you raise the mower deck. It's a little less stressful on the plants. The blades are longer, so they'll shade the soil a little bit, and it conserves moisture. It's about that time to raise the mower deck. And the other thing is, typically, we really don't want to be fertilizing our lawns in the middle of the summer because, as I said, they're semi-dormant, not actively growing. So you're putting down some of these fertilizers, some of these nutrients, and they're not going to really need it or use it. And so things like nitrogen, if it's not used, it's going to degrade. The microbes are going to use it. It's going to wash away or whatever. And so you might want to just hold off on that fertilizer. It's just kind of a standard practice in Pennsylvania. And wait for the cooler weather. So typically we fertilize our lawns in the spring and in the fall. And if you look at the calendar, we are not in the spring anymore.
No. If you look at the thermometer, we don't have to worry about that either.
No, right.
Here's the thing. I have not put any fertilizer on the lawn. I've had the place for a couple of years now. My dad was like every year he would figure out how much lime he needed and how much of this and how much of that. And there was a science to it, which I didn't understand, but he did it through trial and error and talking to our neighbors who knew absolutely everything there was to know about a lawn. And theirs was the best for like 10 miles around. But they worked on it all. You know, they were retired, so they were able to do that. Since I have not been fertilizing it or doing anything like that, I don't know that I have to worry about it, growing too fast or something like that. But is it eventually going to have the point of diminishing returns where I've done nothing on it? And I don't see anybody around here, except the people that have the lawn services come in. They probably do something like that. But most of us who are cutting the lawn ourselves, we're not doing anything for that. And I don't know whether it's hurting the lawn or it's never going to get any greener or any better if I just leave that alone. What do you think?
So I haven't applied fertilizer to my lawn for years. And right now it kind of shows in the sense that when I look out at my lawn, it does not have that nice dark green color. And I'm okay with that. It's a lawn full of clover. I've got these white seed heads, white flowers all over the place, and you know, and that's fine. But the thing with fertilizing your lawn, you're trying to promote the best plant growth as possible, and really vigorous, healthy stands of grass can do a pretty good job of outcompeting most weeds. We encourage that idea of applying lime, you know, testing your pH is basically what you're doing for that. Testing for the nutrients, you know, if you need to add fertilizer. If you are applying herbicides to control weeds, these pesticides can be diminished, but we don't have to rely on them as much if we really promote a healthy stand of turf. But I got weeds all over the place in my lawn, so I don't really care. But, you know, it just depends on what level of look you want. What are the aesthetics? You know, people, when they look at a lawn in certain sections, parts of the country, they want to see a green, dark green carpet.
Yeah.
And when you look at your carpet in your house, you don't want to see something popping up out of that carpet that appears out of place.
Yeah.
It's no different than a yard. You want to see that uniform dark green look. And so that means no weeds.
Well, if I want to see that, I'll go to People's Natural Gas Field and watch the Altoona Curve play because their lawn is beautiful, and I'm never going to have it that nice. The thing, you know, I've jokingly said, well, it's time to mow the weeds. Now, my backyard is pretty much all different types of grass that were added over the years. Some is lighter green, some is darker green, but it's it's grass. The only thing that I inadvertently did is I had buttercups there. So what I would do is I'd mow around them. Now, when you mow around them, they're nice and they look good. But then when you finally go to cut them, they're like a lime green and they sort of like spread out and they do eat some of the space that the grass had. So each year those patches are getting just a little bigger. they're still green, so I'm not really concerned about it. And they're holding the soil. It's not like I'm going to get erosion out of that. But also, I have in the front lawn, I had a lot of dandelions. Even though I tried to get them out, it seemed like I would mow the lawn, and I'd come home that night, and the dandelions somehow grew during the day because that's how fast they were going. The dandelions are pretty much gone except for one or two. But then I got a lot of the buttercups again, and I also got a lot of clover. I've had white clover. Now I'm starting to get white clover and purple clover. And I don't know whether it's the same thing that just changes. I don't really care. I mean, to me, it looks good, and the pollinators love it. So what?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, and so you've talked about these three different weed species. You've talked about dandelions, white clover, and what was that, buttercup. And they're all three are perennials. And so, you can mow off the seed heads, but you've got this vegetative structure under the soil that it's just going to put up new growth year after year after year. And really, the only way to control that or manage that in a lawn is the use of an herbicide. Or I mean, I know you can do this with dandelions, not so much with white clover. I mean, dandelions, you could go and dig up that taproot, but I just don't know how you would dig up white clover because that's a very fibrous root system. So
yeah, honestly, I don't care about the clover. It looks fine, and I'm going to, you know, when I mow it, a lot of it's gone. Some of it isn't. Maybe you've got the mower up high enough where it's not going to destroy it, so I don't know. But that's the other thing about mowing the lawn. I mowed it earlier today as we're recording this. And I did not raise the mower any, but I've got it about three inches up off the ground, and it seems to work. The only time it would be a problem is if I left it go for 3 weeks because it was just pouring rain and you couldn't get out and cut it decently. Then I would have to raise it up, or I wouldn't feel comfortable with it. But it seems that the lawn responds well to this height I've got it right now, wherever that – I presume it's 3 inches, but wherever it's set, it seems to work.
Well, it sounds like you mow your lawn high in the spring, too. So, you know, a lot of times people mow low and then raise it in the summer. So, and that's fine the way you're doing it, too.
Well, I did that based on your recommendation. It seemed to work fine. So,
yeah.
I mean,
I like to mow high because I just like a very dense grass to try to outcompete the weeds.
Admittedly, the first time you mow it in the spring, the way I've got it set, it's very easy. Since the lawn is that high, or, you know, if I let it go for a bit, then I probably should have done it the week earlier, but it just depends on the rain cycle and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So as far as the lawn now, don't fertilize it. Get the mower up just a bit, and I guess if we have a good bit of rain and it's turning bright green or dark green or whatever, green as opposed to looks like it's death warmed over, then you can lower it down just a little.
So here's the thing, Doug, is if you're going to water, you need to commit to watering. You can't go out there with your hose and, I'm going to water this for, 5 minutes. I mentioned in the garden, you need about an inch to inch and a half of water in that garden. That means over the whole garden. And the same thing applies to the lawn. You know how much I have to sit down and do the math, but to put an inch and a half of water over your yard, you know, whoever's listening, or if I look at my yard or you look at your yard, that's a lot of water.
Yes.
My pump will run dry. I can't do that. Or, you know, if you're on city water, what kind of a bill is that going to be? If you're going to commit to watering, you have to water. You can't go out and do a light watering because what I mentioned with a garden, where if you do a light watering, you train those roots to the surface. If you train your roots to the surface for your lawn and you go away for a week or whatever happens and you don't water for a week, those roots are right at the surface and they will cook fast.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
You want those roots deep. Yep, you want those roots deep. So if you're going to commit to watering your lawn, you need to do it properly. And that means, you know, not every day, but it doesn't mean any light watering. It means a good, thorough soaking.
Yeah, so I'd rather it be able to stand on its own as opposed to be dependent upon me if I can't get to it as often as I would like. And also, my dad would, like I said, where I grew up, everybody ran the sprinklers. My dad was able to actually drill a well in the basement and got a pump and was able to use that for the entire yard. We didn't have to use the municipal water. And believe me, out on Long Island, that was a huge money saver. It was, you know, back in the day, it was like $400 for the pump and to drill in. He had some friends who were contractors. They could do that. And we hit fresh water only a few feet down. So that worked out pretty well.
Great.
Yeah, considering that we had a saltwater marsh behind us, half the day it was fresh, the rest of the day it was salt, and the salt water did not get into the well. So because of that, we were able to, you know, save a lot of money, because municipal water out there ain't cheap, and it's not cheap around here either. So I can understand why some people are not all that into doing that. Then again, you know, if you hire a lawn service to do it and everybody has to, I want to mow my own lawn. I'm sorry. My friends were like, when I told them I bought a house, who are you getting to do the lawn? Me. Because they live out on the island. They've got smaller lawns and they just have somebody come and do it for them. I'm not going to do that. I don't want to cheat myself.
Yeah, each their own, Doug. I don't quite get it either, but you know, maybe their time is very valuable. You know,
that is part of it. And this is nothing against lawn services. If you want to use one, believe me, they can do a better job than you, because they're professionals at it and they're going to be out there working at it. I saw one service down the street from me. I've never seen somebody mow a lawn that fast in my life, but they didn't.
Oh, yeah, they
didn't do a lousy job either. They were in and out real fast, but it looked great when they were done. So, teach their own.
Well, your listeners are probably could nod your head to this story real quick. Is that I may have thought about a lawn service every once in a while, because when I asked my kids to mow the lawn, I mean, they had certain sections of the lawn they had to mow. I didn't ask them; they had to do it. It's like pulling teeth. There's fight. There's yelling and screaming. You know, going out and mowing the lawn when it's hot and humid. I don't like to do that. And I look back on it, it's kind of amusing. But boy, that's I can see why some people get lawn services.
Yeah, definitely. But here's the thing, though. I hated weeding, and I had to do that. I would have mown the lawn three times over, as long as they didn't have to weed. But, of course, that was not an option. It's WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen and Tom Butzler is a horticulture educator with Penn State Cooperative Extension. I wanted to ask him, I have a flower garden that just because you buy a bag of flower seeds and think you're going to get a field of flowers, it said native flowers to Pennsylvania. So I did it, and a lot of them got way too big. And I finally got them knocked down, and then I had something else invasive come in, which was competing with the flowers, and I didn't want to go through there because the flowers were there. But now that those flowers seem to be done for the season, either that or they were prematurely shortened and I got the stuff out of there, should I rototill that, or am I just going to tear up all the roots and make it even worse?
Well, I guess it's a tough call, Doug. You know, it depends on what that, either that invasive or that weedy plant that was in there. What was it? You know, if it was a true annual, really, all we have to worry about is just the seed bank that it's left behind. You know,
they didn't go to seed. I stopped it before they went to seed.
Okay, so again, if that was an annual and you got it before it went to seed, that would be the end of the story. But if this is one of these perennials where they come up year after year, they have these what we call vegetative structures. It's how a plant produces asexually. Seed is sexual reproduction. These vegetative propagules are asexual reproduction. So you just need a part of the plant, basically, to start a new plant. And so if these were perennials and they were somewhat established, you're going through with a rototiller, you could break up that underground rhizome. That's one of these vegetative structures that we call on perennials. This rhizome, if it's one rhizome and you go through with a rototiller and break it up into 10 pieces, well, now you have 10 new plants the next spring. So that's where it would really be beneficial for, you know, anyone that's doing any gardening. When they see something in their garden they don't quite understand, is maybe contact the Penn State Master Gardeners. Or there's plenty of apps out there that you can take a picture and have it identify it for you. Because then, once you've got that in your pocket, then you can kind of come up with some sort of management strategy, whether it be, I just need to stop it from going to seed, or I need to pull this now so it doesn't get established and I have a headache further down the road.
Yeah, well, I used a Google app on a thing, and I guess Google Glass or whatever the thing was that you've got on the phone, and it said that it looked like something called wild lettuce. And by the way, when you cut it down, I tried to pull it all out by the roots, but the root system was just so tough on it, I eventually cut some of it, and it said it's a wild lettuce. The rabbits loved it. Not to eat. They wouldn't touch it, which tells me I probably shouldn't either. But they would sit in there because it was very cool, and they just hide. And they loved it for that reason, but they would not eat the stuff. So much for it being edible lettuce. But I got a lot of that, and it was choking out some of the flowers they were in. But most of those flowers went through their natural cycle. They were just spring flowers. They're gone now. So,
yeah. So you sent me that picture, and I think what that is sow thistle. I'd have to look at the picture on a bigger computer screen. But that is an annual. And so and I have some of that in my flower beds also. And so I just pull it. Just to try to prevent it from going seed this fall. It's at right now, it's about, I'd say about 3 feet in height, and I just pulled it. But you did mention it has a pretty nice root.
Yeah,
system,
I hadn't seen too much of that in my entire years, and then I had a whole group of it come into the thing. So I'm thinking either some seeds got in there, some birds got in there, a malicious neighbor got in there. I don't know what it would have been from. But it just came in, or it was some of that stuff that was left over from the big box store. I did get the wildflower mix, and I've got plenty of it, and I will never be planting it again. But that might have been some of the stuff that was left over from that, so I'm not really sure.
Yeah, malicious neighbor. I don't know. That would be an interesting story there. You got a neighbor running around at midnight throwing
Well, you've heard of Johnny Appleseed. Joe lettuce seed. I don't know. It's just that it was all in there, but it's gone for now. But I get the feeling that since I had to hack some of it down, the root system will just make it keep coming back until this fall. At least maybe it'll die off then. And
I think we're talking about sow thistle, which is an annual. Now I haven't bought any wildflower seed in a long, long time. But just briefly going back to grass, when you buy grass seed, when you look at the label on there, it will tell you the percentage of fescue or the percentage of rye grass or, you know, whatever the grasses are in there. But it will also tell you the percentage of weed seed. And so, you know, I just wonder with wildflower, you know, it will give you the breakdown, I would assume, of the different flowers that are in there. But do they also tell you the percentage of weed seed in there?
I'll have to see because I still have the bag and it's still half used. So I'll have to get a picture of it one of these days and send it to you because I don't know.
Put that on.
Yeah, it does amaze me because if you look at the seed catalogs, and boy, do I still love looking in the seed catalogs because it's cheap just to look. It's expensive to buy the stuff.
I'm there with you.
Yeah, I mean, they will sell you a complete garden, a bed of wildflowers, put this many here, put this many here, put this one here, put that there, and this is what your garden will look like. It's like, if you have the expertise of the people who planted it for the picture, that's what it'll look like. It's not a bogus thing. It's just expensive. So, a friend of mine has a garden in her backyard back in Williamsport where I had a little more success with some of the backyard gardening. But she's had like 15 years to build it up. It just looks like a botanical garden in there the way she was able to do everything. I'd love to do something like that. I don't have the space that she had, though. So,
well, you know, in Williamsport, the soils in Williamsport, as long as they're not like on industrial sites, are pretty good because you're dealing with river bottom, basically.
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing people get wrong when they're planting their vegetable garden or putting things into their landscape is just digging a hole and putting in the plant just doesn't mean that that plant's going to grow and thrive and look awesome. You know, people tend to neglect the soils. And if you can add compost to the soils, or leaf mulch, anything that to increase the organic matter in the soil, those plants will pay you back by, you know, multiplying the number of fruit they put out or the blooms on the tree or the flower heads. So we do tend to neglect the soil a little bit, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, and I've used this example before. I have these Scarlet Runner beans. They would not grow for anything where I was living in Greenwood for years. They just would not germinate in the soil. You can't germinate them inside. I tried that years ago. They would grow great in Williamsport. They would grow great in State College, and here it was a disaster. Here I planted them. They're going last year they came up fantastic. Another thing that I tried in both Williamsport and State College, Bleeding Heart or Pocketbook plant.
Yeah. Yep.
No problem whatsoever. Here, I've gotten several. They die. They don't take to it for whatever reason, even if you get a larger one. And I tried getting at least a root ball one time at the big box store, and I had no better luck with that than I got a full grown plant. It would live for the summer, and then it would not come back. So I don't know what it is.
Area or?
Yeah, well, you know, it just for some reason the soil is just different, and I can't explain it. One thing will work one place. I know there's certain people who try to do certain trees or shrubs here. There's no way they're going to live in this climate. But the soil could help or hurt it too, right?
Yeah, right. You know, our soils, you know, when you look at soils, there's three main components, silt, clay, and sand. And so silt, clay, and sand. And wherever you go, those three are in different proportions.
Yes.
All over the country. And so, you know, some soils are really sandy, don't hold water, kind of probably like, you know, your Long Island farming. That's why everyone was or, you know, where you grew up was, you know,
there's so much
out of water.
If there's undeveloped land around there, you'll see sand along the side of many of the roads and highways and some of the commercial places that have not done landscaping. You'll see that there. And a lot of the homes, you know, generations now have been working on it like my dad did for 30 years, working on that soil. So it isn't sandy. But if you go just a few feet away from it. Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, in that native soil that you were talking about, I mean, water drains pretty quickly. And so you have to water very frequently. But if you can eventually add in compost, leaf mulch and build up that organic matter, better to hold that water. But the point being is you have soil types that are different all over the place. My soil type in where I live, Jersey Shore, is completely different than the soil type where you are.
Yes.
Or it was different than in Williamsport. It was different than in Center County. You'd have to pull. They have these soil maps. Anyone can access them. They're online. And you could get a profile of your soil in your area. Now, it's a profile of native soils. If you had soil trucked in, it won't be able to tell you what it is. But, so that's just something people kind of just forget about because you just put the roots in the ground and then you walk away and you never see them again. But soil health is very important.
Well, I don't know if we have a soil map on the podcast, the previous podcast of this program, but I'll double check. And if you want to send me a link, I'll add it if we don't already have it, because we do have like the growth zones and a few other things in the drought zones.
Yes.
We've been adding that to the podcast, so it's on there every month because this is going to be up at WRTA.com a few minutes after the program is over. It's WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen from Penn State, Cooperative Extension Horticulture Educator Tom Butzler. And believe it or not, he was telling me off the air that we should start looking ahead to fall planting. Fall is for planting. I used to think spring was for planting, but you go into the stores, they all got the sign, fall is for planting. And they are right in that. And here's what I'm trying to think about. I've got a bunch of just random flower seeds that I put into a part of the garden where I had some of the invasives. And I was thinking of doing that on the other side as well. But I was also thinking about whether I rototill or not. Let's see what happens. But I could put in a bunch of bulbs to come up for next year. And see how they go. And the bulbs will probably be out by, May? And then I could put in some annual flowers from the stores.
You know,
what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's what some of these, you know, go to arboretums or botanical gardens will do, is that, you know, that you have the bulbs that will come up, beautiful display. But if nothing is follows up behind the bulbs, then there's nothing to see the rest of the year. I mean, you know, the foliage eventually dies back. And so, you know, they'll often complement those bulbs with flowering plants during the summer months, you know, annuals and so forth. So, yeah, fall is a great time for planting. And that's when you would put in your bulbs, at least the ones I'm real familiar with, such as, for example, daffodils. Go buy those and plant them in the fall. Now, the one thing you do need to be careful of, Doug, is that you don't plant too late in the fall. And people do this with a lot of things. You know, people buy mums, for example, put them on the porch and then put them in the landscape in November. That's kind of late because those things need to get somewhat established to get ready for the cold winter months coming up. So, fall is a good time to plant, but you would not want to plant late fall, early winter.
Yeah, so you could sort of, I don't know, plan ahead for now. How early is too early to buy bulbs and how late is too late?
Well, again, I think, you know, anymore, you know, using Christmas, for example, that seems that, the stuff is on the shelves earlier and earlier every year. And so, you know, buying bulbs, I don't know if you would want to be planting them here in the middle of the summer. But, you know, once we start getting towards the shoulder of late summer, you could go ahead and plant, and into the early part of the fall would be also a good time to put those bulbs in. But, yeah, you get into November, and this is ballparking it. Maybe it will be a warm November. But, you know, if normal Novembers, by mid-November, it's, you know, starting to get kind of cold, and it's just not giving your plants enough time to kind of get established and get ready for that upcoming winter.
Yeah. What else should I be doing for the garden, or what else should the rest of us be doing, whether it's getting the mulch, like you said earlier, or just, you know, getting things ready for this fall? I mean, some of the things we've talked about for the winter, I remember, but what about if I start gearing up now for the fall planting or taking care of things by then? It just seems early to do it. But if, you know, again, back time, you start thinking, how long is it going to take to get this ready? And then you start doing it whenever you think, if it's going to be 2 months or 1 month or whatever. What do you think?
Right. Well, you know, a couple of comments. There's a lot there, and I know we have limited time. But, and, you know, fall planting, for those folks who have a fall garden, right now, and this seems odd because we're right, you know, we're only July here, but now's the time to start planning for your fall garden. So that would be like your broccoli and cauliflower, think your coal crops. And so if you like, and I do this, if you like to start from seed, you need to do that in July, maybe early August at the latest, because you need that seed to germinate. You need those transplants to get some size to them, and you need to get them out into the fall garden. Because if you wait too long, you run out of daylight, you run out of heat units in November, and your plant is almost there, but you ran out of time, and that's happened to me also. I just started too late. So, you know, there are plenty of gardening calendars out there that kind of give you a time frame of when to do certain tasks. I know certain master gardeners in some of the counties throughout Pennsylvania have some of these gardening calendars, and that wouldn't be bad to maybe bookmark or save and kind of glance at every once in a while. But some of the other things you want to start, you know, thinking about is lawn care. You know, make sure that you have things ready to go for fall lawn care. If we have a hot, dry summer, which we talked about earlier, and we don't have, you know, timely rainfalls, you might have some dieback in your lawn, and it might be time to do some overseeding this year. Or look at your lawn. If you notice that it's drying out quick, and that when I mean drying out, you see your grass turning browner faster than the neighbor's grass or the grass across the street or whatever, it could be that your soil is very high in clay and it doesn't retain moisture very well. So maybe what you want to do is come through in the fall, because this is a destructive process, but come through in the fall with an aerator. And this is one of those pieces of equipment that takes plugs of soil and throws it up on the surface of the lawn, and then follow up with an application of compost to get down into those holes. And you're enriching that soil, like we talked about in an earlier segment. We kind of forget the importance of that soil, what is below ground. And so and this is something that I think a lot of people are going to have to start looking at as we get into some of these hotter, drier summers. And it seems like as a year, we get plenty of rain, but it's not coming down on regular intervals. There seem to be wider gaps during some of these rainfall events. And so we may need to look at our soil a little more closely and figure out ways for it to hold on to that water a little more tightly. And one of the ways to do that is by incorporating organic matter into the soil.
How much is too much and how much is not enough? I mean, I'm thinking some people used to get bales of peat moss and dig it into the soil or till it in. And I don't know that you want to be
going too far with it. Yeah, you can definitely overdo it, because, you know, if you're using something like compost, you know, it's got some nutrient qualities to it. And so, you know, off the top of my head, I don't know how much is too much. I know there's some references out there, and I can provide you and your viewers or listeners a link to it. But yeah, you know, it's like anything else. Too much of anything could be, you know, detrimental. It's not so much a good thing. There is a number there. But compost is good for the garden. It is good for the lawn. And I do think that it will increase that water holding capacity and better able to withstand, you know, some of these really hot, dry intervals that we seem to be having over these summers.
All right. And we're about out of time, but if people want to contact you, how do they do that?
Yeah. So you can call my office. It's 570-726-0022. But I do prefer email just because a lot of times people are contacting me with problems. And like you do, I prefer people sending me pictures because that way I can look at it and, oh, yeah, I see what they're looking at or what the problem is. So send me an email, tmb124@psu.edu.
And I do ask Tom to mention that in the show because not everybody has the internet. Not everybody can go to the podcast and listen to it again and get those links. But we do have them on the podcast itself, which will be up in just a few minutes on WRTA.com. Tom, anything else to add this particular month?
No, it's probably going to be hot and dry because it is July. And I don't think there's, you know, usually any different. Just try to get out and enjoy your garden. Just do it during the morning hours.
Tom Butzler is with Penn State Cooperative Extension, horticulture educator. Thanks very much.
Hey, thanks, Doug.